Hello, my name is Dave Emery. This is side one of For the Record program number 658, titled Update on the Meltdown. This is being recorded on December 28th of the year 2008, the last recorded broadcast for calendar year 2008. Before we get into the main topic of the program, which obviously is dealing with the financial collapse and attempts at correcting that, we're going to be dealing at great length with the Madoff scandal. But before we get into the main body of the broadcast, this program epitomizes why listeners should use the website. It is by far and away the best individual resource for anti-fascist material, spitfirelist.com. Without a use of this website and the materials on it, the program that I'm about to present to you simply will not impact as it could and frankly should. In particular, the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, about the Bormann Capital Network, what one banker called the greatest concentration of money power under a single control in human history. Without reading that book, or at least reading excerpts of it and an understanding of it, and beyond that, how the Bormann Capital Network and fascism in general are outgrowths of the international cartel system. It's actually redundant, but the international monopoly system that was formed at the end of World War I and that precipitated fascism and the Second World War, it really was the first substantive manifestation of what we call now globalization. One, I guess, could say that a colonial age and the formation of the British East India Company was maybe the start. I think that really what we call globalization began with the Webb-Pomeroy Act and the events after World War I, about which I've spoken so often. But in particular, using the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, the other books that are available for download for free on spitfirelist.com, and cross-referencing those with other program descriptions are essential. In particular, we're going to be talking about the Bormann Network's use of Jews as frontmen and operatives during the course of this broadcast. That is documented at length in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by the late heroic Paul Manning, colleague of and protege of the late Edward R. Murrow, who spurred Paul Manning to do the research on the Bormann Network. Also, talking about another key element of that book and how the German occupation, the German economic occupation of France and other European countries never really ended. Dovetailing the material about the French power elite and their role as a key element of the Bormann Network, dovetailing that with the book Triumph of Treason by Pierre Coe, part of which is available for download on the website, and excerpts of which are available in various broadcasts, that will flesh out listeners' understanding on a couple of key points, namely, again, the role of the French power elite and economic elite in the Bormann Network, and the Bormann Network's use of Jews as frontman is front and center in discussion of the Madoff case. So please, spitfirelist.com. We're going to open up with an article that I'm sure many of you are aware of, and it's important. It's also disgusting. MSNBC.com accessed an Associated Press story. Banks keep bailout spending secret. Subtitled, Banks Unable or Unwilling to Disclose How They're Spending Billions in Aid. Parenthetically, of course, that comes from us, the taxpayers, folks. And the article reads in part, It's something any bank would demand to know before handing out a loan. Where's the money going? But after receiving billions in aid from U.S. taxpayers, the nation's largest banks say they can't track exactly how they're spending the money, or they simply refuse to discuss it. We've lent some of it. We've not lent some of it. We're not giving any accounting of here's how we're doing it, said Thomas Kelly, a spokesman for J.P. Morgan Chase, which received $25 billion in emergency bailout money. We have not disclosed that to the public. We're declining to. Unquote. The Associated Press contacted 21 banks that received at least $1 billion in government money and asked four questions. How much has been spent? What was it spent on? How much is being held in savings? And what's the plan for the rest? None of the banks provided specific answers. Quote, We're not providing dollar in, dollar out tracking, said Barry Kohling, a spokesman for Atlanta, Georgia-based SunTrust Banks Incorporated, which got $3.5 billion in taxpayer dollars. Some banks say they simply didn't know where the money was going. We manage our capital in its aggregate, said Regions Financial Corporation spokesman Tim Dayton, who said the Birmingham, Alabama-based company is not tracking how it is spending the $3.5 billion it received as part of the financial bailout. The answers highlight the secrecy surrounding the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which earmarked $700 billion, about the size of the Netherlands economy, to help rescue the financial industry. The Treasury Department has been using the money to buy stock in U.S. banks, hoping that the sudden inflow of cash will get banks to start lending money. There has been no accounting of how banks spent that money. Lawmakers summoned bank executives to Capitol Hill last month and implored them to lend the money, not to hoard it or to spend it on corporate bonuses, junkets, or to buy other banks. But there is no process in place to make sure that's what's happening, and there are no consequences for banks who don't comply. It's entirely appropriate for the American people to know how their taxpayer dollars are being spent in private industry, said Elizabeth Warren, the top congressional watchdog overseeing the financial bailout. Skipping down, we read still more about the bailout and some of the comments of some of the bankers who've been getting bailed out but don't want to tell us who is exactly in the boat or how much water has been bailed out. We're choosing not to disclose that, said Kevin Heine, a spokesman for Bank of New York Mellon, which received about $3 billion. Can you believe this? We're the taxpayers interjecting. Obviously, this is a bit of spontaneous editorialization. We're lending money to the Mellons, for crying out loud, and to the Morgans, and they are declining to tell us how they're doing it. Well, I think that's great. Just bleeping fantastic. Beginning again, we're choosing not to disclose that, said Kevin Heine, spokesman for Bank of New York Mellon, which received about $3 billion. Others said the money couldn't be tracked. Bob Denham, a spokesman for North Carolina-based BB&T Corporation, said the bailout money doesn't have its own bucket, unquote. But he said taxpayer money wasn't used in the bank's recent purchase of a Florida insurance company. Asked how he could be sure since the money wasn't being tracked, Denham said the bank would have made that deal regardless. Others, such as Morgan Stanley spokesman Carissa Ramirez, offered to discuss the matter with reporters on condition of anonymity. When AP refused, Ramirez sent an email saying, "We are going to decline to comment on your story," unquote. Most banks wouldn't say why they were keeping the details secret. We're not sharing any other details. We're just not at this time, said Wendy Walker, a spokesman for Dallas-based Comerica Incorporated, which received $2.25 billion from the government. Heine, the New York Mellon Corporation spokesman who said he wouldn't share spending specifics, added, "I just prefer if you wouldn't say that we're not going to discuss these details." Well, I'll tell you, it is difficult. On a personal note, for me to read that and not reach into the foulest backwaters of my vocabulary, thereby getting the stations that air this program in serious FCC difficulties, that, folks, that's obscene. It may not be any four-letter words. That is Dave Emery, the Dave Emery Communications Commission's definition of serious, serious obscenity. A very insightful column, perhaps shedding some light on why these banks don't want us to know what they're doing with the money. Obviously, folks, they're really not doing anything good, they'd be telling us. The lack of transparency is only too telling in its own way. The San Francisco Chronicle of December 15th of 2008 carried a very insightful and eloquent column by David Sirota, an up-and-coming author and commentator whose work has been, his op-ed columns have been featured in numerous online and, in the case of the San Francisco Chronicle, daily newspapers, online outlets and daily newspapers. David Sirota has a column called "We Told You So." Please forgive me for saying it. I know it's a tad annoying, but it has to be said to America's ruling class in this humble column space. Because if it's not said here, then you can bet it won't be said anywhere else, and it needs to be said somewhere on behalf of the millions of citizens who were right. We told you so. In the slow-motion train wreck that became the economic meltdown, our bipartisan political establishment and the sycophantic pundit bureau have been wrong over and over and over again. They told us that eviscerating consumer protections would unleash the market's benevolent power and boost the economy. They told us that a $1 trillion Wall Street bailout would solve a credit crisis. They told us that bailout would be subjected to intense oversight and scrutiny. Wrong, wrong, and wrong again. And when critics predicted just that, Sneering commentators and congressional leaders berated us as know-nothing, Luddites, conspiracy theorists, or both. But with the release of three more new reports, there's no debate anymore. The studies proved that the critics were right and the ideologues of Washington were wrong. When in 2005, Congress overwhelmingly passed a credit card industry-written bill gutting bankruptcy laws, progressives were right to try to stop it, and not just because it was an immoral move to legalize usury. We were right because, as the New York Federal Reserve Bank reports, the bill played an integral role in the foreclosure surge that crashed the economy. In the past, bankruptcy laws made sure debtors first and foremost continued to pay their mortgages so that they would stay in their homes. But the 2005 legislation effectively compels debtors to first pay off their credit cards, meaning many of them have no money left to pay their mortgages. The Fed's report estimates that the bankruptcy bill is causing 32,000 more foreclosures per quarter than the economy would have already generated. We told you so. When almost every media voice in America was sounding the alarm of financial panic and demanding a Wall Street bailout plan, when bailout opponents were roundly ridiculed as irresponsible by politician and pundit alike, those opponents were nonetheless right to say then what a study from the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank says now, that the case hadn't been made. While reporters and the Bush administration frantically insisted that bank-to-business lending had ceased, interbank lending had stopped, and short-term commercial paper loans had dried up, the Minneapolis researchers tell us that, quote, all three claims were false and continue to be false, and that, quote, nobody has explained how the money system has frozen when the data says it has not, unquote, and that a, quote, $1 trillion intervention warranted a bit more serious analysis. Unquote. This last paragraph again. Listen to this very carefully. While reporters in the Bush administration frantically insisted that bank-to-business lending had ceased, interbank lending had stopped, and short-term commercial paper loans had dried up, the Minneapolis researchers tell us that all three claims were false, unquote, and continue to be false, and that, quote, nobody has explained how the money system has frozen when the data says it has not, unquote, and that a $1 trillion intervention warranted a bit more serious analysis. We told you so. When lawmakers said that the bailout included strict oversight measures, skeptics were right to say that that claim was patently untrue. According to a new analysis by federal officials at the Government Accountability Office, non-existent oversight means, quote, taxpayers may not be adequately protected, unquote, and that the bailout's stated goal of fixing the economy may not be achieved in an efficient and effective manner, unquote. Yes, we told you so. And so now, even though these damning reports have garnered scant news coverage, perhaps there will be a change. As we, the pragmatic progressive majority, demand tough new financial regulations, job-creating investments in public infrastructure, labor law reforms, universal health care, revised trade policies, a repeal of the odious bankruptcy bill, and an end to Wall Street welfare, maybe our humiliated rulers will start listening. Maybe. Anybody want to bet on it? Send me an email through thespitfirelist.com or through WFMU. And we'll see what kind of odds you want to give us. Another David Sirota column also from the San Francisco Chronicle. This one from Friday, December 26th of 2008. This one called Economic Death and Millionaire Taxes. It reads, for most of us, Benjamin Franklin's words in 1789 still apply. Nothing is certain but death and taxes. However, millionaires by definition are not most of us. While they can't stave off the Grim Reaper, they can persuade lawmakers to shield them from the tax man and balance budgets on the backs of everyone else. That's what's going on in revenue-starved states right now. Governors are preparing to slash middle-class programs and are resisting calls to raise taxes on the wealthy. Nowhere is this class war more pronounced than in New York, the home of the financial thieves who killed the economy in the first place. Having halved its top tax rate over the last three decades, New York today faces a $15.4 billion deficit. In response, Governor David Paterson, a Democrat, might have asked his state's Gordon Geckos to pay higher taxes, especially considering the idea's popularity in polls and the news that Wall Street's elites are still swimming in money. Indeed, according to CBS News, the alleged beleaguered financial industry is so flush with cash it plans to dole out $14 billion in executive bonuses this year. Yet far from forcing robber barons to pay their fair share, Patterson told the New York Times that taxing millionaires, quote, is the last place you want to go, unquote. Instead, he proposes to punish Joe and Jane Sixpack by hiking the taxes and cutting the programs that disproportionately impact them. Specifically, he wants to increase sales taxes, college tuitions and licensing fees, and slash education and low-income health programs. Patterson defended his proposals by telling PBS's Bill Moyers, quote, that when you tax the wealthy in the downturn of an economy, you have an automatic link of a loss of job opportunities and then a loss of population, unquote. The rationale sounds intelligently pragmatic until you peruse the relevant data. When New Jersey recently raised taxes on the wealthy, Princeton University researchers found that most of those who later left the state moved to places with higher taxes, meaning there is no causative link between levies on the rich and residential flight. Likewise, when New York temporarily raised high-income taxes after 9/11, the state added 127,000 jobs, meaning no link exists between higher taxes on the rich and job loss. During times of surpluses, governors could get away with the unsubstantiated nonsense Patterson is peddling, but now 43 states confront shortfalls, and because states cannot run deficits, the dollars and cents of these arguments matter. Lawmakers must choose what policy will create the best chances for economic recovery, spending tax or tax increases, and if the latter, on whom? The answer isn't rocket science. A Nobel Prize-winning economist, Joseph Stiglitz, says reductions in government spending on goods and services are more likely to be more damaging to the economy in the short run than tax increases focused on higher-income families, unquote. That's because government cuts automatically decrease the consumptive spending programs that broadly stimulate the economy, whereas tax increases, when aimed at the wealthy, more often impact funds socked away in savings. The more that the modest tax increases are focused on those with lower propensities to consume, i.e. the rich, Stiglitz notes, the less damage is done to the weakened economy, unquote. Incredibly, Patterson acknowledges how destructive his budget is, admitting that his own, quote, education cuts are draconian, the health care cuts are prohibitive, and the taxes that are being levied are not fair, unquote. So why would he or any governor nonetheless try to legislate such idiocy? Because millionaires are the one who finance gubernatorial candidacies and their campaign contributions by tax protection. The result is what another New York royalist promised: only the little people pay taxes, unquote, said Leona Helmsley, a doctrine that will exacerbate this recession if states keep making it true. Well, again, that speaks for itself. Again, that's obscene, folks. Four-letter words aren't obscene. They're perhaps tasteless, perhaps overly colorful. But when I read stuff like that or the so much of this, it really it taxes my FCC awareness, because it inclines me to reach into the foulest backwaters of my vocabulary. A timely death, perhaps merely a coincidence, perhaps not. New York Times of December 1st of 2008 carried the obituary of Doris Dungey. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, D-U-N-G-E-Y. Doris Dungey, prescient finance blogger, dies at 47. The blogger Tanta, an influential voice on the mortgage collapse, died Sunday morning in Columbus, Ohio. Tanta, who reached for Calculated Risk, a finance and economics blog, was a pseudonym for Doris Dungey, who until recently had lived in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. The cause of death was ovarian cancer, her sister Kathy Stickelmeyer said. Thanks in part to Tanta's contributions, Calculated Risk became a crucial source of pressure and analysis as the housing market at first faltered, then collapsed, and finally spawned a full-blown credit crisis. Tanta and her extensive knowledge of the loan industry to comment, castigate, and above all, instruct. Her fans range from the Nobel laureate Paul Krugman, an op-ed columnist for the New York Times who cited her in his blog, to analysts at the Federal Reserve who cited her in a paper on understanding the securitization of subprime mortgage credit. Well, certainly a very conveniently timed death. Perhaps it was just coincidence. The stated cause of death was ovarian cancer. It is a matter of fact that by the early 50s, the intelligence community had perfected means of assassinating people through cancer. In the age of genetic engineering and the use of so-called magic bullets, which can target medicines and perhaps, who knows, carcinogens or other toxins, or perhaps genetically engineered cells, to specific tissues, I wouldn't dismiss. I would also note that, for example, the late Dr. Larry Ford, who collaborated with the apartheid regime in South Africa in its biological warfare program, Project Coast, did so on behalf of the Central Intelligence Agency, an individual who used the Turner Diaries as his political Bible. This guy was basically an obstetrician, and so he might very well have been in a position, or somebody of that ilk, to do something like that. By the way, one of the late Dr. Larry Ford's clients was Margot Hemingway, who died precipitously of an alleged overdose of drugs. Who knows whether Larry Ford prescribed those drugs to her and whether he actually structured things in such a way as that well-known liberal would have died. I believe that Larry Ford is one of the people who should be investigated in connection with the anthrax attacks. Before we launch into the Madoff scandal, and we're going to be devoting the rest of the program to the Madoff fund collapse, there's a quote from roughly 1937. The late Walter Benjamin, the black sheep, so to speak, of the Frankfurt School of Economics, an individual who died in 1940 trying to flee Nazi Germany and get into Switzerland, had the following. Now, Benjamin was influenced by Marxist ideology, as the rhetoric here will be clear, although not a Marxist. I do think that there are some insights that the Marxist school has provided that do have a certain amount of validity. Again, I think there are fundamental flaws in Marxism, particularly its prescriptions for the ills of capitalism. But on the other hand, the following, I think, is only too relevant in this time. The late Walter Benjamin, again, the black sheep of the Frankfurt School, had the following to say about 1937. With the upheaval of the market economy, we begin to recognize the monuments of the bourgeoisie as ruins even before they have crumbled. Amen, Mr. Benjamin. Now, the Madoff Fund. Bernard Madoff, a Jew, someone we will talk about in connection with Mormon Jews, and also some of the damage he has done, certainly to Jewish fortunes, literally to Jewish philanthropy, and to a certain extent to funding Israeli infrastructure. Bernard Madoff had a $50 billion Ponzi scheme going. Its collapse was revealed the largest Ponzi scheme in history. And Bernard Madoff would have us believe, and those who are taking this enormous scandal at face value would have us believe, that in effect, he is Lee Harvey Madoff. He is a lone, not necessarily a nut, but a lone procreant or miscreant under the circumstances. CNN.com website has the following. Did Madoff act alone? This is by Katie Brenner, dated December 19th of 2008. It's originally from Fortune magazine. Did Madoff act alone? It's hard enough to legitimately manage $50 billion. To falsify books and hide that big a sum, though, experts suggest Bernard Madoff had help. But who? Well, later on in the broadcast, where I'm going to suggest maybe who helped. But let's read a little bit of this. Like the conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman, the theory that Bernard Madoff acted alone is hard to swallow. True, Madoff had allegedly confessed that he perpetrated a massive fraud that left behind $50 billion in losses, and he claimed to have done this all alone. But this is a man who kept false records, sent bogus documentation, bilked investors for billions, lied for years to friends, and knowingly harmed charities. It's within the realm of acceptable behavior to cast a jaundiced eye upon his confession, skipping down. Quoting Ron Geffner, a partner at the law firm Sadis & Goldberg, who specializes in structuring, organizing, and counseling hedge funds, it's hard to imagine that given the amount of assets that he managed, that people would not have been aware. If nothing else, employees, no matter what floor they were on, would have known that somewhere within the firm money was being lost, Geffner adds. Well, we're going to talk about some people who had seen this coming, and we're also going to talk about something. One of my favorite quotes comes from Nietzsche. A joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. Later on, we're going to talk about the quote accounting firm, note the quotes, that was keeping track, allegedly, of Madoff's operation. It's funny in a really sick and very disturbing sort of way. But Lee Harvey Madoff, as I'm going to call him for the rest of the broadcast, was not alone nut. His disclaimers to the contrary notwithstanding, there were a lot of people involved in this. The San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, December 18th of 2008, among other sources, provides us with information about one of the people implicated in this, or in, as I like to call it, the milieu of Lee Harvey Madoff. Or as a trusted friend and colleague said, a community of interests, or as the Germans and Nazis called it, Interessengemeinschaft. IG Farben stands for a community of interests. The following is an AP story, Dateline Washington. It's by Pete Yost and Marcy Gordon. Headlined, Attorney General Recuses Self from Ponzi Scheme Investigation. The fraud investigation of Wall Street money manager Bernard Madoff took unusual twists Wednesday as the U.S. Attorney General removed himself and the Securities and Exchange Commission looked into the relationship between Madoff's niece and a former SEC attorney who reviewed Madoff's business. Skipping down, U.S. Attorney General Michael Mukasey recused himself from the Madoff probe because his son Mark Mukasey is representing Frank DiPasquale, a top financial officer at Madoff's investment firm. The Justice Department refused to say when Mukasey became aware of the conflict, but confirmed Wednesday he is removing himself from all aspects of the case. DiPasquale was the Madoff employee who had the most day-to-day contact with the firm's investors, unquote. So Lee Harvey Madoff, at the very least, the investigation into Lee Harvey Madoff's crimes has caused the attorney general to recuse himself because his son is the attorney for one of the principal players in this operation. Another of the questions, Where Did the Money Go? By Rachel Beck of the Associated Press. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, December 24th of 2008. It reads in part, again, the title, The Madoff Mystery, Where Did Money Go? It has become the biggest mystery to emerge from the $50 billion Bernard Madoff scandal. Where did all the money go? Federal investigators are likely to take months trying to answer that question as they dig through the disgraced investor's records and attempt to unravel what may be the biggest financial fraud in history. But several theories are being discussed among financial experts and at Wall Street water coolers, Palm Beach country clubs, and the offices of university accounting professors. Among the theories, Madoff lost a bundle in bad investments, paid some of the money out to investors, stashed cash in foreign banks, and spent some on his lavish lifestyle. There was also the possibility he inflated his claim of $50 billion in losses. Well, we're going to examine this at some length down the road. Later on, actually, in Side 2 of the program, which is going to begin because we're almost out of time on Side 1. Suffice it to say that the available evidence suggests very strongly that Lee Harvey Madoff was not the lone perpetrator of this particular operation. We're going to take a look at some of the individuals and some of the institutions that figure very largely in this. Again, as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, this program exemplifies why listeners should use SpitfireList.com. That's the website which I've put together with the heroic efforts of a remarkable webmaster. But let me tell you, folks, there is more and better information about anti-fascism on that website than anywhere else you're going to look, and it's growing all the time. And this program also exemplifies why listeners, serious listeners, should use the descriptions for the program, because there will be information in the description that I do not have time to put in the broadcast itself. Also, many of these programs are admittedly very dense. They're not easy to follow. I do not intend these to be the final word on these things, but rather something of a journalistic step-up transformer to inform others. Please use the SpitfireList.com website. Use the descriptions. Use the audio files that are linked and the linked websites, in particular the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and the excerpted description for the Record 305. That'll give you information about Bormann Jews and about the French elites, the French economic elites' role in the Bormann network, because it certainly looks like Lee Harvey Madoff was not a lone nut. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 658. Update on the meltdown. This has been recorded on December 28th of the year 2008. My name's Dave Emery. Happy New Year.